study session of University City Council to order at 5:30 p.m. You have before you the agenda for tonight's meeting. Does any member of council have a change to the agenda? Boyne.
Thank you, Mayor. I would like to add to council reports and business just a brief discussion about the newspaper article about the request by the trolley director or president for the TDD to support Bi-State. And again, just have a, and also, we'll just add that to as a discussion item.
Okay.
If that's.
I'm not sure that's what you'd like to do.
Yeah, I would. I'd just bring that up.
I mean, it's not really on. There's no notice. There's no notice to the public for this.
Okay, so then I'll save it for.
I mean, I think you're welcome to comment on it. I'm not sure.
I can't. Okay,
right.
That's fine.
Right.
Okay, I can do that.
Honorable Mayor and Council Members, I was just having a discussion with our city attorney. That would be a pretty substantive item to add as an agenda item, but certainly if you just wanted to make comments regarding it, you're open to doing that.
Changes?
Excuse me, may I address that issue? And while it may be substantive, we don't know when the mayor may make that decision, but I think that the mayor would have to have the approval of council in order to make that decision to support it. So do we want to talk about it, or do we want to push it off a few weeks? I'm certainly willing to push it off a few weeks, but knowing that the mayor cannot speak for the council.
Honorable Mayor, Mayor Pro Tem, I think for that type of item, it would be better to have it posted because there may also be public comment that you might want to have regarding it, and that would not afford the public to comment on it if we simply added it to this agenda.
And I agree, just so long as no decisions are made prior to discussion and vote of council.
Honorable Mayor, Council, Mayor Pro Tem, certainly there are, I think the mayor has certainly heard the position of the that you're taking on this, and I'm sure that he will consider that. I'm speaking for him, he's right here, but I'm certain that he would consider that as a part of going forward with this item.
There is no scheduled meeting that I know of the Loop TDD coming forward, and I believe that I have a pretty good sense of where the council is, and I'm happy to have conversations with everybody. I'm not sure exactly what all the limitations are, and I think we've all had these conversations over the past 10, 12 years, if not longer. So, but to the best of my knowledge, there is no scheduled meeting of the TDD. There's no action to be taken by that board. There's no action to be taken by me. I am more than willing to have conversations with any and all of you. I am more than willing to have conversations with Bi-State. I'm happy to have conversations with the mayor of St. Louis, the county executive. I would love to get as much information as I can before the Loop TDD board ever discusses that matter.
My position is still that when the mayor speaks for University City, he speaks with the approval of council. And so if there is a final decision to be made, whenever it is, that it should be a public issue and a vote of council, not a consensus or a speaking with somebody on the side.
Then I just wanted to add to that, and that was my whole point of having the discussion, in that we're clear, because I don't remember that ever being a discussion with this group of council. And so I just wanted to get clarification and make sure that I understood where we were headed with that. That's all.
Any other changes?
Honorable Mayor, there is one other change that I would like to propose. It would be moving item K4 from recognition to D1. I've drafted a proposed proclamation for Black History Month that I would ask you to consider.
Thank you. Would you like to now introduce our guest, or Libby, or?
Yes. Honorable Mayor, Council members, as you know, for several months, we've been working with our consultants to really drill down on the market within University City for hotels. We currently do not have any hotel in University City, but certainly believe that we have a strong market for it, but wanted the data to back up that belief. And Libby will be introducing the presenters to share that information that they were able to put together for you.
All right, so tonight we have with us representatives from HVS. It's a local firm. Hospitality Valuation Services is what HVS stands for. And Daniel McCoy is the principal that's been working with us on this project. We did issue an RFP several months ago, and they were came out as one of the top contenders for this work. And so we're pleased to have him and his associate Chris Cabrera here as well, who's helped with a lot of the research on this. So a lot of great data in that report, so I think he's going to kind of narrow it down for us and simplify it a lot to talk about their findings tonight. So welcome, Daniel.
Thank you. Can everyone hear me okay? Yeah, so we have been working on this study for a few months now, and I guess I would put together some slides just to kind of take you through the process and the key findings, and then I'm sure some of you may have questions, which I'd be happy to answer. I guess background on myself, I'm based here in St. Louis, and we are a local office of a national, actually an international firm. We only work in the hotel sector, so pretty much everything we do is feasibility studies, market studies, appraisals, other types of real estate and operational consulting for the hotel world. What we did here for University City was really a market study and a feasibility analysis. So the first step was to really look at the market area and the drivers of demand and the existing competition in the market area and do an analysis of that and provide some oversight and insight of kind of high-level potential for hotel development. And then from there, identify a specific site that we drilled down on and a recommended hotel product for that site, and then provided performance projections and financial analysis and a cost projection for what that project would look like, and then a feasibility finding. So I'll run through that, and then you can ask me any questions that you may have. So from the get-go, we identified four potential areas for hotel development, and really based on existing commercial development clusters and transportation networks. And then we evaluated each of those four sites based off of transportation access, proximity to commercial hotel demand generators, proximity to leisure hotel demand generators, and then the level of services and amenities in the neighborhood for hotel guests. And then we graded each of those sites on those four characteristics on a scale of 1 to 5, from 4 to excellent, and came up with an assessment of each of the sites, and really they all score at 3 or higher, and so they're all viewed by us as having some hotel development potential. The strongest site was site area number 3, which is at Forsyth and Forest Park Parkway, and that scored the highest really across the board with more than adequate scores in each of those categories, whereas some of the other sites had definite positives and some drawbacks that would either need to be overcome or would limit the profile of a potential hotel in those locations. So in terms of the demand generators, I think this is, of the categories we evaluated, this is the most important. And really, we divide these into two categories of are they bringing in travelers that are here for business, or are they bringing in travelers that are here for leisure? Typically, leisure travelers are more seasonal, stronger in the summer, peak travel season, and also on weekends during, non-summer periods. But because that is a little bit more limited in terms of day of the week and time of the year, the commercial demand generators are a bit more important because those generators are bringing in guests that are going to fill a hotel room, Monday through Thursday night throughout the year and really provide a solid demand base. And so you can see here from where University City is, the majority of the demand generators are along the outskirts of University City to the south, a little bit to the west, and a little bit to the east. And so that was part of the reason why the site area number four, which is furthest to the south, number three, which was furthest to the south, was the most desirable. It was closest to those commercial and leisure demand generators. This table here shows how we looked at the existing hotels in this submarket of St. Louis that are going after demand from the same demand generators that were identified on the previous slide. And we've broken these up into the different service levels that the hotels offer. You've got full-service hotels, which traditionally larger, attracting more leisure and meeting and group demand with in-house banquet facilities. You've got boutique hotels, which typically have a food and beverage component, but less focus on meeting and group demand. Limited service hotels, which generally are focused on transient guests, and then extended stay hotels, which are capture a fair amount of demand from transient guests, but also have the facilities to capture longer-term stays. And then at the very bottom is select service as a category, which falls somewhat between the full service and the limited service. Typically, they have a food and beverage outlet on site that's going to serve multiple meals, but they don't have the robust meeting and group facilities. And so we also looked not only at the level of service, but the class, which is kind of akin to a price point or is it luxury? Is it upscale? Is it mid-scale? And the brand family, if it's affiliated with a reservation system and a national brand, and then their room count. And so we looked at all of this information to try and see what's out there already, where the gaps may be in terms of being able to serve the demand base from the demand generators that we identified. So this table or this slide illustrates the actual performance of the set of hotels that was presented on the previous slide. And so in the hotel world, we look at the raw data being the number of available room nights per year and then the number of occupied room nights, and that gives you the market occupancy, and then there's the average rate that's being charged to those guests, and the combination of the average rate and the occupancy gives you a revenue per available room or RevPAR metric. And so really that's the furthest column on the right is RevPAR, and that really is an indicator of the overall health of the market and overall performance of the market. And so you can see that, you know, in the bar graph above, performance has been improving over the last several years. And the actual data below, you can see that, you know, RevPAR increased from under $70 in 2009 to over $113 in 2018. So the market has been improving pretty strongly in the current economic cycle. And so that would indicate that there's definitely potential for hotel development in this market. We then looked at the top data table here, which is the day of the week by month occupancy over the last year for this set of hotels, with the nights over 80% occupancy highlighted in varying degrees, kind of a temperature chart in terms of when is demand the strongest and when these existing hotels may be turning away demand that could be captured by a new hotel in the market. On the bottom of this slide, we've got a list of the hotel developments in the submarket that are either currently under construction or at some level of the development process. And so we also considered those and what impact they will have on the market going forward as potential future competitors for anything that would be developed in University City. And based off of this analysis of when demand is the strongest and where the demand is coming from in the existing competitive market, we recommended that at the site number 3, which we ended up focusing on as the strongest site, the ideal hotel improvement would be an upscale select service hotel that would be approximately 165 rooms. It would have a bistro-style food and beverage operation and modest meeting facilities, fitness room, structured parking. We did not settle on a specific brand, but included in the study a selection of potential brands that meet this facility and operating profile. We then looked at actual construction budgets for similar properties throughout the Midwest, including a few in the market area, and based on that came up with an estimate of what it would cost to develop the recommended facility, which if you look at the bottom table shows those comparable estimates, and the top table shows that it would be approximately a $35 million development. And then we went through and took the recommended property type and projected its performance from an occupancy and rate standpoint, and then from an income and expense standpoint to get to projected levels of operating income over a 10-year pro forma projection period. You can see the first table on the top left shows the top line occupancy and rate and RevPAR data, and then the second table below that shows the bottom line profitability and net income data, and the table on the right hand side shows a stabilized operating statement for what we projected the hotel would do. And then taking the projected financial performance of the property and analyzing the net income against the cost to develop the property, we came up with a measure of return on investment for a potential equity investor and compared that to typical market returns or market requirements for a hotel equity investor. So if you look at the top table that's showing the projected yield for the project, and that's divided into what a typical mortgage would be and what an equity investor would receive at 17%. And then we've, on the lower left hand, there's a table that indicates typical equity returns for hotel investors based on property type. And so if we look at the select service property type, which is the middle row, the average is 18.5, but there's a range of 13 to 26, which is typical. And so this would be a little bit below average, but definitely within a reasonable range for an equity investor, and on the whole, a pretty strong project at this location that would be attractive to equity investors in the current market. And that was the conclusion of the study. I'm sure you all may have questions you'd like to ask me, or if you want me to go back to specific slides that you had questions on.
When you're talking about the being a little less attractive, is that typically when then the developer is coming to us to make it more attractive?
Typically, yes. So, I mean, at 17% as an equity return, that's I don't think it's below the average, but the average includes a wide variety of hotels that are 10 or 15 years old or 20 years old that someone is buying at that point, or in tertiary markets or suburban markets. So it's below average, and even if it's not below average, most developers will probably come to the city and ask for some sort of subsidy to get the project done. But at 17%, it's probably not going to make a break. It's not going to require a huge subsidy package to draw a developer in for that. Into that, it would probably be adequate or close to adequate on its own.
Yeah. Ms. Carr?
Thank you. So you're specifically talking about the one at I-170 of Forsyth or Forest Park Parkway and sort. This is the one that you are looking at?
Yes.
And how do the others look?
So we did not take the analysis to this level with the other sites. Basically, we evaluated the market and the sites and came up with an overview of what could potentially be ideal for those other sites, but did not then do the financial projections and return analysis for those other sites.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't give you to this level of detail on those sites, but if we go back to site number one, I think our recommendation was that a limited service property would probably be ideal for that location, and that the success or specifics of the property would probably depend on the nature of the planned redevelopment at that intersection, and whether and what the supportive nature of the development looks like in terms of supporting a hotel operation. Site number two, I think we recommended we identified that as a potential site for an extended stay hotel, which I believe one has been proposed for that site. And for site number four, we said that it would be have potential for a leisure-oriented hotel development, something like a boutique hotel that would pretty heavily target the leisure demand that's being produced by the Loop.
Are you aware that there are a couple of developers that have come to the city with plans for sites 2 and 4?
Yes. I don't have a whole lot of specifics on that other than what's been available publicly.
Thank you.
Honorable Mayor, Mayor Pro Tem, just to add on to the response that you received, we were aware that there were interest in hotels and sites 1, 2, and 4. And the information that we receive will be provided to those developers that are considering those sites for hotels. The reason we selected site 3 for a drill down is because that site currently is not being considered by any developer. And so the intention is to provide the information that we received to Washington University because they have the largest vacant, well, the largest unused parcel of land that we think would be a great location for a hotel. And we are also aware that they are currently looking at what is possible for developing that property. So we would share this information not with just WashU but with all of the developers that are interested in developing hotels in University City.
May I ask you a question then? So would this hotel be on or off the tax rolls if Washington University built and ran it?
I'm going to Mayor Mayor Pro Tem. Our intention certainly would be to have it on the tax rolls. I don't know how they would create that nexus between a luxury hotel and education. But yeah, then to answer you specifically, the intention would be for it to be on the tax rolls.
I'm not sure who's next. Tim, Stacy.
Thank you. Thank you, Mayor. I appreciate the presentation. I'm just curious, is there a weighting associated with the stage of development of a hotel as it factors into your calculations? So what do I mean by that? We know, for example, that the Delcrest one is, you know, according to you seeking entitlements, the Centene Campus Hotel is in early development. So in early development, something may or may not happen. Do you weight that in any way?
Yeah, so what we basically do is we look at what is definite and include that quantitatively in our projections.
Yeah, because the elements is like almost built, isn't it? Close to it.
Right. Yeah. The loft and the element are under construction. They're opening soon. The AC by Marriott in the Central West End is definitely moving forward. The Town Place Suites is not yet under construction, but looks like it will be in the near future. And so those were the ones we focused on quantitatively because they would potentially open in the 2 to 3 to 4 year window where we're focusing on kind of the current market dynamics and what that looks like. And so then we're identifying those projects that are maybe 4 or 5 years down the road, 6 years down the road from opening and considering them qualitatively. But historically in the hotel development pipeline, only about 1 out of 2 projects that's publicly announced, you know, roughly gets done, if that. So we don't overly consider the stuff that still hasn't received financing, hasn't received approval and entitlements.
A couple other things quickly. And I'm just curious. I'm not necessarily looking for a specific figure here, but how often do you find that a hotel is not feasible for an area?
It's not uncommon that I would come back. Well, let's put it this way. I do a portion of my work I do for developers, and a portion of my work I do for civic entities similar to University City. And so if I'm working for developers, most of the time they're experienced in putting together hotel deals. They've already got a brand lined up. They've got a prototype and plans, and they're basically just needing a study for them to turn around and get equity or debt investors. And so they know what they're doing, and they've already put together their project, and they need a third party to vet it. And so I would say 90% of the time or more, those projects are feasible or close enough to feasible that there's a conversation with the developer on how to make it feasible. When I'm working with cities or other civic agencies, this is probably one of the stronger projects that I've worked on. The majority of the time, I'm telling the city from the get-go, if there was a need for a hotel, there would have been a developer knocking on your door already. But there's already developers knocking on your door and building hotels here. So there's, you know, there's a definite market for hotel development here. Most of the time, a lot of times when I'm working with cities, at this point the conversation turns to there's not enough demand here for what you have in mind. If you want that, you need to be prepared to offer X, Y, and Z to the developer. I don't think I need to have that conversation on this project.
Thank you.
Tim?
Thank you, Mayor. I have one question. When you look at the needs for a hotel, you came up with the four different options, are those options just based on what the market will bear in terms of rooms, or do you look at meeting spaces, conference capabilities, and other types of activities other than just a place for someone to stay over the night or long term?
So the meeting and group facilities are typically, I guess, more sought after by municipalities because they value the guests that are going to stay here longer and spend more money on more than just the rooms. From a development standpoint, in the current market, it's not really profitable to build ballrooms and event space. The money is in the rooms and not in the banquet and event operations. So that would be so basically, if you look at what is being developed by the private market, it's almost all almost all falls into the select service or boutique category. There's very little full service development taking place in St. Louis or anywhere in the U.S. for that matter, unless it's highly subsidized by a city that wants a new convention center, headquarters, hotel, or wants a conference center. I would say if you had come to me and said, do a study for a full-service hotel with a conference center, I think that's when I would at this point be saying, if you want that, this is what you're going to have to offer in terms of tax breaks or, TIF subsidies or something along those lines.
I'm not sure, Blaine or Jeff. Blaine?
Well, I just have a quick question. With site number one, that's at Olive and 170, are you aware that that's an opportunity zone, and would that matter or figure into your equity numbers in reference to the capital gains tax savings that they would?
Right. So I was not aware that specifically was an opportunity zone, but opportunity zones have obviously become more prominent in development over the past couple of years. And I think that is a factor. I don't have data on how much of a factor it is. I know that it's not necessarily unique to that location. The Element and the Aloft that are in the Cortex District are in opportunity zones. And so it's definitely something that, or an opportunity zone, it's definitely something that is a factor out there, but it wasn't explicitly considered in our recommendations.
Okay, and then my last question is very simple. In reading this, it states that the city is home to only a limited number of hotel rooms. I don't think we have any hotel rooms. I'm not sure.
So, okay, I can revise that.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify it.
Mr. Hales.
Thank you. So with the proposed Centene Campus Hotel, that project I think is certainly not going to end up looking like it started. If that doesn't happen and there's not 200 rooms within a stone's throw of location 3, would that impact or alter your recommendation for either the type or the number of rooms?
I don't think so. Not explicitly. From my knowledge of the Centene Campus Hotel, the most recent iterations that I've heard of is something very high end that wouldn't necessarily compete with the select service property.
And How recent is your information on that? Because I think
it's not super recent. So okay. I mean, from what I heard was that was the last time I heard anything specific. More recently, I've heard just that it's TBD, basically.
Right.
But I had specific knowledge of what was originally planned, and it was something very high end. So right. I can only assume that it wouldn't come down too far from that, but I don't know, and I don't know what it'll look like.
Thank you.
But to that point, I think, in general, the Clayton, Richmond Heights, Brentwood area around that intersection of 64 and 170 has absorbed hotels very quickly and very easily, and the hotels that have opened there have very quickly ramped up their operations and been some of the top performing hotels in St. Louis. And so it's kind of a situation where this general submarket is one of the strongest, if not the strongest, in St. Louis. And so, if one hotel gets developed and another one doesn't, or vice versa, I would have to see how things shake out over the next 5 years to know specifically whether one hotel development happening or not happening has a major impact. But overall, my general sentiment is that this submarket could continue to absorb hotel rooms well and relatively easily.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Thank you all.
Thank you. Honorable Mayor and Council members, the next presentation is an update from our Public Works Director, Sinan Aplasan, on where we are with putting together a ordinance to govern scooters.
Good evening. The update is on the scooters. We call them scooters now because they are the most active form of micro-mobility device, that is, in the public rights of way currently. Last time we were here, the discussion at another council study session was about Lime bicycles, shared bicycles at the time, and that was about a memorandum of understanding. The Lime bicycles are not around anymore. Even Lime scooters are not currently, but we understand that they're on their way back. So the picture shows these vehicles in use. Missouri State Highway Patrol has a definition for scooters that are a form of motorized bicycles, and so they are legal to operate in the public right of way on the roads, not on the sidewalks, and they must comply with the rules of the road. And I included in the in the definition a slight distinction about these micromobility devices versus the scooters in the definition of the state law as compared to the e-scooters that are the micro-mobility devices as termed now in the transportation industry, they actually can be construed the same vehicle. And because the only limitation about the motorized bicycles is that they should not exceed the 30 miles an hour speed. And so these vehicles obviously don't. They can go up to 16, 17 miles an hour under the right conditions. We call them now e-scooters. I also am aware of would like to bring it to your attention that there is a state bill that is currently defining the scooters, e-scooters, for usage in the public right of way. It's not passed to become law yet, but it's in consideration. E-scooters, scooters overall, again, according to the Missouri State Highway Patrol, these require the operation by qualified individuals that require a driver's license, and per our state law, they cannot be under the age of 16, and they have to obey the rules of the road. we're all aware of the concerns about these vehicles in our public right of way and the need for regulation. In fact, your most recent direction to us is pursue regulation to regulate this use. Especially, our concern is are the business corridors down Mar Boulevard and Olive Boulevard. These areas present a higher pedestrian traffic on the sidewalk. Of course, when these e-scooters are operated on the sidewalk, and the street in the in both sections, the streets are not conducive to this type of usage. In Dalmar Boulevard, in the Loop area, we have slower speeds, but we have the trolley tracks in the area, and Olive Boulevard is either 30 miles an hour or 35 miles an hour on the street. In our residential areas and the business areas, another concern is that these vehicles are parked every which way in the public right of way. That's an untidy situation that happens, that they can block sidewalks, they can block driveways, they can block curbs and gutters, parking areas on the pavement. They can trip pedestrians, especially overnight when they are not as visible. These are the general concerns about these vehicles. A timeline of events until now. The City Council study session I earlier mentioned, that was in August of 2018. At the time, the major concern was the Lime bikes, the shared bicycles, but I think we also discussed the scooters. A memorandum of understanding for a limited usage by that one vendor was proposed. Lime bike or Lime is not, Lime is not in the bike business anymore, but Lime scooters are just temporarily not around. We thought that they went away. They have not. And I talked to the City of St. Louis. According to them, they are on their way back. When the weather warms up, they are deployed back. And in fact, there are many more companies that are looking to get into this sector of business. We had a traffic commission meeting discussion in December of 2018 about the matter. We collected input from the traffic commission, talked generally about the implementation in the nearby adjacent neighboring municipalities. The Traffic Commission had concerns, and they wanted to make sure that these vehicles, when they are allowed to be operated in our right-of-way, that to be done in a safe manner. That was their one major emphasis out of that meeting. We engaged a consultant that does work in this area, in the micro-mobility area in general, and they looked into the matter for us, checked into other national, regional, local, and national implementation with respect to this item, and came up with certain policy recommendations. And we preliminary recommendations, we went to Traffic Commission with those over the summer and got some feedback from the Traffic Commission. And one of the issues that that was raised then was what about the users, how they handle themselves, conduct themselves when they ride these vehicles, such as riding while impaired. So we took them back, did some more work, and so eventually went to the Traffic Commission, back to the Traffic Commission in November, last November, and so and proposed the certain policy recommendations for their consideration. So some of them are deployment areas and maximum number of vehicles for our community. So this is all under proposed to be done under a permit in our community. And so the deployment areas are, there are some recommended areas in the more highly traveled zones. In Dalmar Loop, there are certain sections. And a maximum number of vehicles was defined as 300 for our community. No parking zones. I have a slide about those. No parking zones are areas where the geofence, the GPS based restrictions can be applied to these vehicles. So these are mainly the private subdivision areas. Parks is another concern, whether we would want these vehicles in the parks or not. They are not currently proposed as part of no parking zones. But certainly these areas are in our preliminary recommendation. What happens in these areas is that the vehicle does not disengage, and so the user is not able to complete their trip, and so they need to get out of these areas to be able to do that. User vehicle requirements, helmets, headlights, and even tail lights. Rules of the road, sidewalk, street, direction of travel, opposing direction. And so as a traffic professional that practices in this area, I believe that these vehicles belong to the roadways, the paved areas, not the sidewalks. And so the sidewalks usage on the sidewalks pose a lot of conflicts because the pedestrian travel speed and these vehicles' travel speed are they are different. There is a big difference. There is a considerable difference between the two, and they can move fast in different directions. So it's very difficult for a pedestrian to anticipate that type of a conflict. And even the user of the vehicle, for that matter. ability to geofence. So geofencing is for not being able to park as well as limit the speed of the vehicle. And that's possible. Ability to communicate message to user via vehicle screen and amenities. So this would help in a vehicle entered a private subdivision and they cannot park it, for them to know where how they can get out of there and park their vehicle. And so there is that communication ability that we require as part of our permit, the proposed permit. Ability to use, report use data, and making a dashboard available to us, to the city, so that that's done by the company, so that we can track information regarding the usage of the vehicles. And ability to assess fees to user for non-compliance. So this is one question mark. We are not sure if they are able to do it. In my conversation with the city of St. Louis and the other nearby cities, it's not referenced. This issue is not referenced. And so we'll certainly explore that more. response timelines by permittee and penalties. And so these are the requests to bring issues, non-compliance issues, into compliance, what timelines apply.
Mr. Absalon, if you might, for the sake of time, I might move to the last slide.
Sure.
And advise the council with regards to what we are considering. I know that WashU already has a policy in place that they do not, as I understand it, allow scooters on campus, how that might be affecting us, and when we are looking at bringing forward an ordinance for them to consider.
Washington University has a geofence in their campus, Danforth campus, so that limits the vehicles to 5 miles an hour, and so the vehicles cannot go any faster than that, and that's a bit faster than walking speed, and they cannot be parked in those areas. So our proposal, which we would like to bring back to Mr. Rose's attention, with an amendment, proposed amendment to our municipal code sections, applicable municipal code sections, as well as a permit program layout for this implementation, is I anticipate being able to complete that in the month of March. And with that, by the time that these vehicles are expected to be deployed back into the public right away with the warmer weather, we can be ready for that.
We have about a little less than 10 minutes before the open session.
Thank you.